As Russia's invasion of Ukraine enters its sixth day, what's the situation on the ground as a large column of Russian forces reportedly continue their advancement towards Kyiv?
Russian forces stepping up attacks on cities and towns across Ukraine, striking at civilian infrastructure and communication facilities, including Kyiv's iconic main TV tower.
Plus, a call for more aid for Ukraine.
The purpose of allowing us to scale up our activities, not just in the Donbas area where we used to work for the last 8 years.
And later in the program, Asia's reaction to Russia's war in Ukraine. Today is Tuesday, March 1st. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. Ukraine's second largest city faced increased Russian shelling Tuesday, while a column of Russian forces stretched out along a road north of the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv on this sixth day of Russia's invasion of its neighbor. European Union Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell said on Tuesday that Russian shelling of civilian infrastructure that took place on Monday in Kharkiv violates the laws of war. In addition, in Poland, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said NATO will hold both Russia and Belarus accountable for what's happening in Ukraine. Now, a short while ago, I spoke with reporter Jamie Detmer in Lviv for an update on the situation on the ground.
Well, in fact, oddly enough, Russia and Ukraine had their first prisoner exchange today, 6 days after the Kremlin ordered the invasion of its neighbor, but that was on a day of further mayhem and destruction across the country, with Russian forces stepping up attacks on cities and towns across Ukraine, striking at civilian infrastructure and communication facilities, including Kyiv's iconic main TV tower. Now, the Russians are saying that they had to do that because they're trying to prevent information attacks on Russia. And they warned residents in Kyiv who were anywhere near any security, intelligence, or communications buildings to leave. So it's been a battering day on Kyiv. We also know, and it began building up last night, of this, as you mentioned, this huge column of armor coming down from the north, about 20 kilometers north, 30 kilometers north of the city, which is last night was about 17 miles long. According to Earth observation satellite companies, it's now more like 40 miles. And clearly tomorrow, there is going to be a major push on Kyiv, and this is going to be a major battle. We've also heard from the Ukrainians that Belarusian forces were involved. This has been denied by their president, Alexander Lukashenko. Across the country, though, again, its towns are being pummeled, and we've seen the evidence of residential districts being hit. You mentioned our Kyiv, yes, the square, I mean, square with was hit in Ukraine's second city. The Ukrainians saying that they have killed over 5,000 Russian soldiers, which is something which is denied by the Kremlin. And we've still got this refugee evacuee surges going on from east to west.
Jamie, can you speak more about that? Because the latest UN estimates have put the number of people who have fled Ukraine at well over 600,000.
Well, there's 600,000, according to the UN, a relief agency, a refugee agency, about 600,000 Ukrainians have left the country. We have got huge flows within the country. I mean, the displacement is enormous. I don't think anyone could put an accurate figure on it. Let me give you an example. You know, you drive from Kyiv, let's say, to Lviv, a normal car journey of 8 hours. It's taking people up to 35 hours to make that journey. It took me 20. And we stopped off for some kip, for some sleep for 4 or 5 hours on the way. We were exhausted. All the borders are inundated. The Polish borders are the worst, where the waits can be 2 days. That's if you're in a car. If you're not in a car, you've got to march, as Sean Penn, the Hollywood actor, did today, 40 kilometers on foot to get to the border. And we're seeing this across the borders. Slovakia, with Romania, with Hungary, with Moldova. Some borders are a little bit easier than others, but then if people try to get down there, it's got worse again. No, people are waiting for a very long time, and it's noticeable that in Lviv now, in the center, we're seeing more more evacuees appearing, having given up at the border, seeking accommodation, seeking food, pulling their wheelies behind them or struggling with huge backpacks. It's pretty desperate, Steve. And the Lviv mayor has talked about trying to get more border crossings open near here to Poland. But people are making extraordinary journeys across the country to try to get to a border that they think will be easier to cross.
Thank you. Jamie Dittmer in Lviv, Ukraine. Thank you very much for your reporting, and please stay safe.
Take care.
VOA's Heather Murdoch sent us this tape while she was traveling in her car Tuesday from Kyiv to Lviv, describing the scenes on the road and the situation in Kyiv as she left.
Right now we are driving from the Ukrainian capital Kyiv to the western city of Lviv. We've been on the road for a couple of hours now, and we have seen many checkpoints, often manned by civilian armed groups that are assisting the army right now of Ukraine. We understand that there is a corridor of Russian troops north of the capital Kyiv, some say as long as 50 kilometers, and we have been told that today might be the last day for the near future that people can travel safely out of Kyiv to other cities. Yesterday there was a crunch of people leaving the capital, and we understand in the past week more than 500,000 people have left Ukraine for the border countries. The Ukrainian capital is now experiencing shortages of fuel for cars. Cash machines are either empty or closed. We're not sure which. Most businesses are closed. Few groceries are open. And those that are closed during the curfews. Over the weekend, we had a curfew from Saturday afternoon till Monday morning. And last night, there was a curfew from 8 p.m. until this morning. Peace talks are continuing between Russian and Ukrainian officials, but many people here fear that this is just a respite before the violence begins again. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, on the road from Kyiv to Lviv in Ukraine.
The Kremlin denies the Russian military has used cluster munitions in Ukraine, insisting that its forces have only struck military targets. The AP's Charles de Ledesma is up next.
Spokesman Dmitry Peskov says troops don't conduct any strikes against civilian infrastructure and residential areas, a claim which contradicts abundant evidence documented by the AP of indiscriminate shelling of homes, schools and hospitals across Ukraine. Peskov also rejects accusations the Russian military has used cluster munitions and devastating vacuum weapons, dismissing the accusations as fabricated. The Defense Ministry said for the first time on Monday that it suffered losses, but didn't name any numbers. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Peskov also said that while direct negotiations between Moscow and Kyiv had begun, there were no plans for talks between the two countries' presidents. He also added that sanctions placed on Russia will not change the Kremlin's position on Ukraine. Tuesday evening, we'll also see U.S. President Joe Biden address a joint session of Congress amid war in Europe and problems at home. VOA will carry the address and the Republican response live beginning at 2 a.m. Universal Time Wednesday morning. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani has this look ahead.
It will be the president's first State of the Union speech.
The facts support the president if he will indeed say what all presidents want to be able to say, and that is the state of our union is strong. It is strong.
University of Virginia presidential historian Barbara Perry points to strong employment, among other things. But Americans are worried about inflation and the virus pandemic. And while the president will have to address the war,
I don't think at this point Americans are very engaged in what is happening in Europe, for good or ill.
She says the president has to explain how a distant war will affect people here. Sagar Magani at the White House.
Speaking at the United Nations Human Rights Council Tuesday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken urged members to send a resolute and unified message that President Vladimir Putin should unconditionally stop his unprovoked attack.
Reports of Russia's human rights abuses and violations of international humanitarian law are mounting by the hour. Russian strikes are hitting schools, hospitals, residential buildings. They're destroying critical infrastructure, which provides millions of people across Ukraine with drinking water, gas to keep them from freezing to death, and electricity.
As the world continues to watch Russia's invasion of Ukraine and its ensuing war, conflict has raged on Ukraine's soil in the Donbass region since 2014. Leticia Courtois is the International Committee of the Red Cross's United Nations Permanent Observer. She began our conversation by detailing why the organization is calling for $272 million in aid to help those affected by the war.
The purpose of allowing us to scale up our activities, not just in the Donbass area where we used to work for the last 8 years, but also to address the immediate needs of the people affected by the current hostilities taking place in the major cities, as well as to support people that will be and are moving outside of Ukraine in the neighboring countries. The UN has given very impressive numbers, and those people will require immediate support, be it in terms of shelter, water, psychosocial support as well, just to deal with the trauma that the whole situation has been for them. In Ukraine, the idea for the ICRC is to step up our immediate support to medical services, providing to the hospitals to allow them to take care of the increasing number of wounded people, the sick and the injured, maintaining the pipeline that has been also disturbed because of the capacity to bring in supplies. This is particularly true for Kyiv, but also supporting food, water, provision, and in terms of household items that the people need in this particular situation. Some people have been sheltering in their basements for the last 6 days and are really in dire need of basic assistance. We will also step up our support to families that have been separated, trying to reunite them, put them in contact, and facilitate any communication, particularly for people, between people detained and their families, to ensure that they know about the whereabouts of their family members. And we will also work at ensuring that dead bodies are treated with dignity and that families of the deceased can grieve and find closure. Last but not least, there is also a component on the remnants of war, the contamination of all the areas that are currently under hostilities from an exploded ordnance. And this is a concern that we have had in the region for many years now, and that is obviously increasing by the scale of the conflict taking place.
You mentioned that the ICRC has been in the Donbass region since 2014, and the fighting has never stopped. By some reports, there are well over 10,000 people who have died. What can you tell us about the humanitarian aid and assistance that's been needed for the past 8 years?
Yes, that's correct. The situation has been very preoccupying in the last year. 2014, we have developed and increased our presence to seek structures along the line of contact to try to address the needs of people being directly impacted by the ongoing hostilities and the impact it has on basic services. I'll give you an example. Since last week, we've been trying to fix the water system in the Donbass area that brings water to a million people and has been damaged by the hostilities, and therefore people are cut off from this basic necessity. It's been very difficult, particularly for people that cannot move from their houses, who need support, and obviously COVID has complicated the whole capacity to support and reach out those people for the last month and years. We all have seen the reality with this very number of shocking images and witnesses as well, and testimonies from people bringing really, really heartbreaking testimonies of their current situation. And I think we are, from our team on the ground, experiencing the same distress and really echoing the urgency of an immediate response.
Leticia Courtois is the International Committee for the Red Cross's Permanent Observer at the United Nations. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much, Steve, and don't hesitate.
The United Nations is also appealing for $1.7 billion to assist in delivering immediate humanitarian aid to Ukrainians and refugees in neighboring countries. According to the UN, around 12 million Ukrainians will need relief and support as the conflict between Russia and Ukraine escalates. An additional 4 million Ukrainian refugees are expected to need protection in surrounding countries during the next few months after Russia invaded Ukraine last week. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. Australia says it plans to spend $50 million to buy missiles and ammunition to support Ukraine. Phil Mercer reports Prime Minister Scott Morrison made the announcement Tuesday during a press conference.
As the conflict in Ukraine intensifies, the Australian government has shifted its stance on sending military hardware to Ukrainian forces. Last week, Canberra said it would provide only technical assistance. That has changed. Now Prime Minister Scott Morrison said his country will buy military equipment and weapons for Ukraine as part of a coordinated effort with other Western nations to help its armed forces resist Russia's invasion. It's unclear how quickly the armaments would be delivered. Prime Minister Scott Morrison made the announcement at a media briefing on Tuesday.
We're talking missiles. We're talking ammunition. We're talking supporting them in their defence of their own homeland in Ukraine. And we'll be doing that in partnership with NATO. I'm not going to go into the specifics of that because I don't plan to give the Russian government a heads up about what's coming their way. But I can assure them it's coming your way.
Australia is also contributing $25 million toward humanitarian support for international organizations that are helping Ukrainians in an evacuation effort as they leave their country escaping the conflict. Hundreds of thousands of people have left to seek asylum and refuge in neighboring regions. Prime Minister Morrison has ruled out sending Australian troops to fight in the war. He's also urged Australian citizens not to travel and join Ukraine's militia in the ongoing fighting against the Russian military. Morrison said the legal position of foreign combatants in the conflict was unclear. Legal experts say Australian laws prohibit citizens from joining in other countries' conflicts unless they're members of an official foreign army. Morrison said Russia has self-selected themselves as a pariah state following its invasion of neighboring Ukraine. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Following Russia's invasion of Ukraine, governments across Asia are joining international sanctions or imposing sanctions of their own. And it's more than just U.S. allies as well. In this story by VOA's Bill Gallo, even some countries that try to take a more neutral position are condemning the Russian aggression.
The last time Singapore imposed unilateral sanctions against another country was 44 years ago. That's when it punished Vietnam for invading Cambodia, then called Kampuchea. But this week, Singapore announced sanctions against Russia over its invasion of Ukraine. Foreign Minister Vivian Balakrishnan said the issue strikes at the very heart of smaller nations' right to exist and prosper. Lim Tai Wei teaches at the National University of Singapore. He says Singapore is one of many smaller countries that feel vulnerable if the current world order is not protected.
It takes sovereignty very seriously. The thinking is that if a vulnerable country can be overrun, it can happen to other small countries as well.
It's not just Singapore. Many of East Asia's largest economies, from Japan to South Korea to Australia, announced similar moves. Japan has been especially loud in condemning Russia. Prime Minister Fumio Kishida said he told Ukraine's president he stands with Ukraine and offered unwavering support for Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. The anti-Russia sentiment is far from unanimous in Asia. Most prominently, China and North Korea have defended Russia, saying the root cause of the conflict lies with the United States. In Southeast Asia, most governments have remained silent. Last week, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, released a statement on Ukraine that refrained from describing Russia's actions as an invasion. In fact, the statement did not mention Russia at all. Lim says that's because many countries there have strong economic and military ties with Russia, stretching back to the Cold War.
In ASEAN, some of them have very close, traditional, long relationships with Russia, so they will be a bit more cautious. So in this sense, voices of U.S. allies like Japan and South Korea and strategic partners like Singapore are perhaps more at the forefront of the moves like sanctions on Russia.
But even among U.S. allies, the Ukraine situation could be altering ties with Russia. Both South Korea and Japan had pursued better relations with Moscow. Those efforts now seem in jeopardy. Russia's ambassador to Seoul this week said South Korea-Russia ties had improved for 30 years. Now, he said, things seem to have changed course. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul, South Korea.
The sites in Berlin where the Nazis surrendered to Soviet and Allied forces in 1945, which is now a museum, has become embroiled in the current war between Ukraine and invading Russian forces. Henry Ridgewell rounds us out.
May the 8th, 1945, victorious Allied commanders arrive at Berlin's Tempelhof Airport. The official Nazi capitulation is signed at this former military barracks in East Berlin, captured by Soviet forces. War in Europe is over. The site is preserved, sponsored by an association of German, Russian, Ukrainian, and Belarusian historians, and known as the German-Russian Museum until now. Following Russia's invasion of Ukraine last week, the director decided to fly only the Ukrainian flag at the front of the museum. The German-Russian Museum name plaque has been obscured. Museum director Jörg Moray explains, "Normally, we display all four flags," he says, "Germany, Russia, Ukraine and Belarus. We see it as an important symbol that we sympathize with Ukraine. Ukraine is the victim here. She was attacked. That's the only point to make. So today, we raised only one flag." The dispute goes far deeper. In World War II, Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union. Nazi atrocities against the Soviets are well documented. Many of those crimes took place on what is now Ukrainian soil. The site of the Nazi capitulation became the German-Russian Museum in 1994, after the fall of the Soviet Union. Two decades later, Russia invaded Ukraine, annexing Crimea, and the museum found itself at the center of a dispute over its name.
Again, Jörg Moray.
He said our Ukrainian colleagues have difficulties working in a museum called the German-Russian Museum. From the German point of view, it was sufficient for quite some time to say we have a museum with Russia, but it's a bit inaccurate. Russia was taken to mean the whole of the Soviet Union. For a long time, that didn't bother anyone. For the Germans, it's very important to have a museum together with our former enemies in war. But we've learned now that it's important to distinguish between Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus. On the eve of launching his latest invasion, Russia's president said it was aimed at the denazification of Ukraine. Russia has repeatedly compared Ukraine's government to the Nazis and accused them of committing genocide. Ukraine has strongly rejected such claims and points out that its president, Volodymyr Zelensky, is Jewish and has a grandfather who fought against the Nazis. Museum director Jörg Moray is outraged by Putin's language. "This is a misrepresentation," he says, "a corruption of history that I would never have expected. Perhaps we have indeed learned nothing from history. It is a history that is still contested."
Germany and Europe believed war was a part of history never to be repeated, to be remembered in museums like this. But as conflict returns to Europe, Russia is invoking the language of 20th century conflicts as its tanks roll into Ukraine. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Berlin.
And that's going to do it for us today. You know, the news doesn't stop when this program ends, so be sure to stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine, as well as news and events from around the world 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com and following VOA News on your favorite social media platform. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and have a good night.